Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Here's what we're looking at.
Now, anybody that says it's coming down, when you look at all of the migrant crime and all of the other crime,
claims this election cycle about an immigrant crime wave, but what do the numbers actually say? Mexicans make up over 20% of Chicago's population, a new report highlighting their history and the challenges they still face. And as Chicago celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month, we hear who inspires you. And now to some of today's top stories. The jury deadlocks in the case of an AT&T executive accused of bribing former House Speaker Michael Madigan. A federal judge declared a mistrial after the jury deliberated for nearly 15 hours before announcing a stalemate on all counts against AT&T Illinois President Paul Lasquiaza. He was charged nearly 2 years ago in a five-count indictment that alleged he engaged in a conspiracy to bribe Madigan. The parties will meet again early next week to decide next steps, including whether there will be a retrial. CTA President Dorval Carter says a proposal to merge Chicago's three transit agencies won't make life better for passengers. Speaking at the City Club today, Carter said state lawmakers must tackle a funding formula that has left public transit agencies fighting for scraps. With more funding, Carter says the CTA can reverse past service cuts and create bold new options to meet future needs. Carter and the leaders of Metro and PACE say merging their agencies won't create major savings or improve service.
I've been attending hearings all over this region where there's been a never-ending conversation around what transit looks like versus what it really is and what we want it to be. Well, if you want to have a world-class transit system, you have to be prepared to pay for it.
We've got much more in Carter's pitch to lawmakers on our website. The smell of smoked weed doesn't give Illinois police officers the right to search an adult's car without a warrant. The Illinois Supreme Court issued the ruling today, saying the order of burnt cannabis is insufficient on its own in providing probable cause to perform a warrantless search on the vehicle. But the court says officers can legally conduct a warrantless search if the smell of smoked pot and other factors are at play. Illinois legalized the purchase and use of recreational marijuana in 2020. It's a victory for community leaders on the northwest side of Chicago in their years-long fight against gentrification. The city council has unanimously approved the Northwest Side Housing Prevention Ordinance, which covers gentrifying communities like Humboldt Park, Logan Square, Avondale, Hermosa, and Westtown. If an apartment building with up to four units goes up for sale, tenants will get the first opportunity to buy the building from their former landlord. And property owners who want to tear down buildings of the same size will have to pay an additional fee of up to $60,000 per building. Up next, challenging the narrative around immigrants and crime. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Of an immigrant crime wave have been a major talking point this election cycle. However, immigrants are far less likely to commit crimes than U.S.-born residents. That's according to a recent data published in the National Bureau of Economic Research. But presidential candidate Donald Trump has doubled down on the rhetoric calling for a mass deportation.
I can say this. We will do large deportations from Springfield, Ohio. Large deportations. We're going to get these people out. We're bringing them back to Venezuela. You know, he told Biden he's not accepting anybody back. They moved all their criminals, not all of them, but the rest are moving in now. They emptied their jails in Venezuela, emptied their criminals, emptied the nests.
Joining us now to explain more are University of Illinois Chicago history professor Lilia Fernandez, Sylvia Diaz, director of mental health services at Erie Neighborhood House, and via Zoom we have University of California Davis economics professor and the study's co-author Santiago Perez. Thank you all for joining us today. Santiago, I want to start with you. Your study found that over a 150-year period, Immigrants have never been incarcerated at a greater rate than those born in the United States. What does this tell us about the connection between immigrants and crime rates?
Yes, so thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah, so that's part of the study that I co-authored a couple of years ago, and then we have recently released. And yeah, that's exactly what we find. We are finding that over the last 150 years, immigrants have had lower incarceration rate than the U.S. born, suggesting that, you know, at least in the U.S. context, there's not much of a connection between immigration and crime.
And Lilia, so immigrants aren't contributing to violent crimes in high numbers, and violent crimes have been steadily decreasing for the last three decades, but it seems like we're always hearing about immigrant crime. Some reports are saying that Venezuelan migrants are taking over Aurora, Colorado, and Haitians are eating cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio, just to name a couple of things. How did immigrants, particularly immigrants from Global South, get stereotypes as criminals and violent?
Well, they're not the first to be stereotyped in these ways, and this narrative that immigrants are criminals is a very old and tired textbook fear-mongering technique. And if we look at the 1700s, the Germans were maligned. In the 1800s, the Irish. Later, in the late 19th and early 20th century, the Italians, Russian Jews, Poles, other Southern and Eastern European groups. So this is a technique that political candidates in particular like to use to stir up anger, to stir up fear, to get people, to rile them up and get them out to vote. But the reality is that, it's not the case. You know, the few crimes that immigrants might commit might get sensationalized or exaggerated or blown out of proportion, and then make the headlines and cover or on the news.
And Sylvia, I want to go to you. Chicago has welcomed over 40,000 migrants in the last 2 years. You work with new arrivals. What can you tell us about people's experiences arriving here at the shelters at this moment?
So it's very unfortunate to hear people cast judgment on them, right? Especially if we're thinking about their context of exit. A lot of these individuals did not choose to leave their home, right? They did not choose to come to a country that is predominantly English, right? Where they did not choose to go through a whole migration journey, where a lot of these individuals have disclosed that they've slept in the Amazon. They had to go on by foot a lot of the path, cross through countries where they were also discriminated against, right? Because unfortunately, us as Latinos, sometimes we do discriminate against each other, right? And a lot of have shared with me experiencing abuse in borders, various borders, right? And up to when they get here, right? And a lot of them have arrived in the cold with no experience, right? I had a mom who had hypothermia because she arrived in December, had no jacket, nothing to keep her warm, and then ended up being hospitalized.
And the people that you're working with, are they aware of these narratives that are being told about them?
I'm sorry, who do you mean?
Like the narratives of, I just talked about that, they're stereotyping them as criminals.
I think when they experience it out in public, they are aware, but when they first arrive, they don't realize it, right? They're just here, their focus is their family. A lot of these individuals are just focused on feeding their kids, making sure they're safe. Some of them are running away from violence as well, right? We have a lot of past army officials, right, that are also being persecuted over there.
In Santiago, part of your study says that immigrants today are doing better than previous generations, particularly when it comes to the rates in which they're incarcerated. What do you think happened?
So, yeah, I think that this is actually a pretty surprising finding of our study. If you listen to the narratives around immigration, it's always about how things are getting worse. And, you know, we actually find pretty much the opposite. So we find that if you compare the relative rates of incarceration of immigrants in the past to those today, in relative terms, immigrants are doing better today. So we consider a number of explanations for this. So, you know, it turns out that a lot of the things that we thought would explain this end up working. But one thing that we document in the study is that this is part of perhaps a broader phenomenon where if you look at how immigrants today are doing, particularly relative to less educated U.S.-born individuals, they seem to be doing better along a variety of dimensions, including, you know, how attached they are to a labor market, how likely they are to start a family. So this seems to be part of a broader phenomenon that is perhaps not specific to crime, and that it could be related to forces such as globalization, automation, that seem to have, in relative terms, affected the local population more than the immigrant population.
Lilia, do you believe that reports like this are important to debunk these narratives?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of work to be done to re-educate the public and give them actual facts and data. You know, the rhetoric that we're hearing from political candidates like the former president suggests that we are being overrun with immigrants, that the country's being invaded. And if you look at the numbers, actually, just as a point of comparison, in 1880, cities like Chicago, New York, San Francisco were between 40 to 45% immigrant. If you add their children, they were up to 80% of the population. We're nowhere near that today. And so I think that people really need to inform themselves and educate themselves about the facts, not just the hysteria and the rhetoric that's circulating.
And Sylvia, what else needs to be done to better integrate asylum seekers into our communities, you would say?
I would say making sure their basic needs are met, right? Making sure they have housing, they have proper nutrition. That's very important. I've had families that are living in hotel rooms, living off of Maruchan, right? That's not proper nutrition for them. And also providing them support services like case management, mental health, right? Because a lot of people are coming with traumatic experience along their journey.
And do the same question that I asked her, do you believe studies like this are important?
Absolutely. As Lilia said, it is important for everyone to be informed and go off of facts, right?
At this point, many people, some of the asylum seekers have been here for 2 years. What do you want people to know about them?
I want them to know that they're human, right? And I would love for people to put themselves in their position, right? Think of yourself as a mother, as a father. What would you do if, you know, because I hear people make comments of, well, why would they make their children go through that experience, right? But when you're coming from a place, right, again, thinking about the context of exit, when you're coming from a place where your children, you're watching them deteriorate, or you're waiting for someone to come and shoot you, you're going to do whatever you need to make sure they're safe and healthy.
And Lilia, we only have a couple seconds, but we talked and we've heard Trump talk about if he is president, he is going to conduct the largest deportation in history. Quickly, can you talk about how the threat of deportation has been used in our country's history?
It's been used repeatedly throughout the 20th century, really, and even before that. And it's often in times of economic downturns. It's targeted at particular groups, Mexicans in particular. Have been the ones targeted in this way.
Well, thank you so much for all of your input. Thank you, Santiago. Up next, we explore an extensive report on the city's Mexican population.
Connection to instant fun.
The biggest thing. And you're willing to lose for money?
The newspapers called it the crime of the century.
Al Capone was public enemy number one.
All I could see was fire.
It did look like a war zone.
They took a stand and said no. That changed American history.
House music is more of a feeling than it is a sound.
I love this town. My dreams came from here. It really was a Chicago story.
One in five Chicagoans have Mexican heritage, but despite being a part of Chicago's since 1950s, there hasn't been a major academic study on their history and impact on the Windy City. A new report released just in time for Hispanic Heritage Month aims to fix that. Here to talk more about their findings are Luis Gutierrez, founder and CEO of Latinos Progresando, Jose Muñoz, executive director and CEO of La Casa Norte, and Linda Tortolero, president and CEO of Mujeres Latinas in Action. Thank you all for joining us, and nice seeing you guys again.
Great to see you too.
Nice seeing you too.
Luis, I want to start with you. What was the inspiration behind pursuing the study?
Well, you know, the Mexican community is a large community in the city of Chicago, and one of the things that we realized when we came together is that there was not a lot of information on who we are. And so as we start to do work in our city, creating programming, thinking about policies, it was really important to create a baseline so we know where we are and where we want to go.
And Jose, what was the process like on collecting this data? Can you take me down through that journey?
Well, I mean, first it took a lot of us meeting and brainstorming what we really wanted to do, because, I mean, there's just so much information that's missing that we need to get out there.
It was about six of you, right?
Yeah, five of us total. Luis is the one who spearheaded getting us together. But just coming up with the idea of what kind of data we wanted to collect. Now, the most surprising thing was when we started collecting data and UIC started working on this project, was that there just was not enough information to capture everything that we wanted to share.
Especially knowing that, you know, the settlers, the first Mexican settlers have been here since the 50s. Linda, I want to go to you. What are some of the, would you say, the consequences and risk of not having comprehensive data available like this when it comes to making decisions on policy?
Well, I think for us, what's really critically important is to make sure that we're thinking about the particular needs of ethnic groups and national origin groups within the Latine diaspora here in Chicago. So that's important. I think the other thing, too, is that we have to make sure that we are asking the community what they want, but also doing research specific to them. So one of the highlights of our approach doing this was doing focus groups. We did several focus groups where we're asking community members, what do they want to see in terms of community growth, but also what are the challenges with regards to identity, leadership, health, education, economic development. And that to us is really important to get that kind of firsthand knowledge.
And identity is a big one. I want to go back to the start of the report because it stood out, addressing the problems in the hit TV series, The Bear, which features no Mexican lead, when according to the U.S. Census, about 44% of all cooks in Chicago are of Mexican origin. Luis, why was it important to include this?
Well, I think in general, one of the things that we're seeing is that there is not a lot of representation at of Mexicans on a lot of levels. So when you look, whether it's government, philanthropy, nonprofit sector, or, you know, media, TV, movies, we don't really see representation of the Mexican community. So a report like this is extremely important because it gets the conversation started. Now we can sit down and actually look at data and then look at the field and say, does our population and our economic contribution match the positions that we're being put in?
And Jose, what were your thoughts when you started watching The Bear and realized, I think there's only like Mexicans in the credits or in the beginning credits?
For me, it's just more about the fact that, again, you know, we are, as Mexicanos have built Chicago, continue to build this city, they're all over the country. We have congressmen, folks in high levels of government, not enough, but we do have a lot of folks that are leaders, yet when you look at TV, we're not represented there. When you look at how funding is distributed among different communities in there, Mexicanos continue to lag behind. So that's why it was important to tell this story and really take a focused look at who Mexicanos are and the fact that we've been here for hundreds of years. Someone actually shared with me an interesting fact. They told me and they reminded me that anywhere that you see corn, Mexicanos that had a presence. And you think about what some of the major exports is here for the state of Illinois, is it's corn. You know, so we've been here much longer than people give us credit for.
That's really interesting. Linda, during the study, your focus group covered health and the suburbs. The data shows that two-thirds of Mexicans now live outside the city. Can you explain the migration pattern and what were some of the notable observations you made from the suburban communities?
That's a great question. So the first thing is that, like the rest of the United States, we have a housing crisis. And so our Mexican community members, they are looking at affordable housing options. Home ownership is incredibly attractive. We have higher rates of home ownership than we even knew. And it's hard to own in Chicago. And so living in the suburbs is very attractive. The other thing that is shown through the data that we have a higher household, 4.3 in terms of our size. And so we have multiple generations living together. And so the suburbs offers that option. But the other thing we have to note is that with the more recent migration of Mexicanos here in the area, they're going directly to the suburbs. They're not stopping in the city anymore. And as historical neighborhoods like Little Village and Pilsen become more expensive, they're moving southwest and they're moving into the suburbs.
That's really interesting. I mean, when my parents migrated here, they went straight to Rogers Park, or like so we know, Little Village or Pilsen in the city. Luis, also from the study, we also saw that Mexicans make up 20% of Chicago's population and 70% of the Chicago's Latino population, but it's still difficult for Mexicans to obtain a business loan or a home loan. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, you know, when you start to look at the numbers, 1 in 5 people identify as being Mexican. And so when we look at the resources that are coming into our community, whether it be a home loan or a business loan, and, you know, Mexicans are entrepreneur, and so we want to open businesses. There just have not been loans and resources that are offered directly to the community and that are explained to them in a way that they understand it. There are some loans and some things that are available for our community, but a lot of times our community doesn't trust what is coming. And so, you know, we have to prepare information in a cultural sensitive way, and those things are important.
Jose, what would you say now moving forward that you want people to take away from this report?
I want people to look at this report, look at the data, look at the information, and know that, you know, yes, Mexicanos are here, and we are a very large population. We skew very young, so if we're going to invest in Mexicanos, an investment in Mexicanos is an investment in the city of Chicago and the future of our entire region.
And Linda, what would you say are some of the policy recommendations that you want people to hear?
I think, first of all, we need to collect national origin ethnic data from government organizations and not-for-profits that receive this information. There are differences among the ethnic groups, and not just with the Latina diaspora, but other groups as well. That's the first one. I think the other one is that we have to make sure that we are encouraging the development of educational attainment in our community. One of the data points that was very shocking is that Mexican students and CPS go to school every day. They have great attendance, but they are not having high performance. We need to dig more deeply into that. Why is that happening? What is needed to provide the right wraparound supports for
these
students?
Isn't it 89% of students
identify? 86% of Mexican kids go to CPS in Chicago. And so that's something that is really shocking when we know education is our pathway to success.
And Elias, what is the goal now to get this information out?
So the goal right now is to talk to as many people as possible. We've created a site, MexicanChicago.org. We're encouraging everybody to go there, take a look at the report, download it, have conversations with your family, your friends, have your conversations at work. Feel free to invite us to come out and talk to people. We need to talk. This is the first step in a long line of what needs to happen in the next couple of years.
And we only have a couple seconds, so I want to go around the room and just one word to describe your identity.
Mexican.
Mexicano.
Mexicana.
I love it. Thank you so much for all of you for joining me.
Gracias.
Gracias.
Up next, we hear about who some of you look up to. But first, a look at the weather. Singer Selena Quintanilla, activist Dolores Huerta, writer Sandra Cincetos, and politician Jesus Chuy Garcia are known as Latino trailblazers. As Chicago celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month, we wanted to hear from you about a Latino person who has influenced or inspired you. So we hit the streets, and here's what some of you had to say.
Person that I look up to the most is my mother, by far. I mean, she raised my sister and me. She provided for us throughout our childhood, through college. And even when we've had some arguments, she's always been there for us.
A couple people that go by the name of Alma. The first was my grandma, Alma Adoracion Santana. She was a kindergarten teacher that was driven to uplift marginalized identities. And she was passionate in education, which inspired my mother, Alma Betsy Santana, to go into education herself as well.
Bueno, a mí me ha inspirado lo que es Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, por ser en su época, por ser una mujer que a pesar de las adversidades que tenía, ella buscó la manera de estudiar y de seguir adelante.
The woman that I think I look up to the most, who's been a really big inspiration for me, has been a trans woman who was born and raised in this neighborhood. Her name was Reina Valentino. She was the first person to teach me about outreach, about HIV prevention. Unfortunately, she passed away due to HIV, which led me to come into the field. It inspired me to be able to lift up my community, spread the awareness, and get people tested so we can be able to go ahead and just overcome the stigmatism of HIV.
One of the most significant things that we did about 50 years ago is to have named a building for Roberto Walker Clemente, the first Latino named building in Chicago. And the school was mostly Latino. So at that point, we decided that in 1972, when Roberto Walker Clemente died, that we would honor him for being a great baseball player, but a humanitarian because he was part of the civil rights movement, to name the school after him.
And I have to say that my biggest role model has been my father. He migrated to Chicago when he was 17 years old, worked really hard to open his small painting business, and somehow got my two brothers and I through college. So thank you, Dad. And that's our show for this Thursday night. If you're looking for new ways to explore your neighborhood and communities across the city, check out our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. You can sign up at WTTW.com/newsletter. And while you're there, catch up on stories you might have missed, like the latest on taxpayer funding for stadiums and a baby hippo capturing social media by storm. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 and 10 for the weekend review. Now, from all of us here in Chicago tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is committed to supporting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives throughout the legal profession.